So, Michael, can you please tell me about the selection of Eastmere to be the Domesday Village?
Well, this happened very early on in our time in Eastmere. As ever, I was asked to sit on a committee to discuss how Eastmere would react to this. What had happened was that Edward Roberts and a historian at the Hampshire Museums called Elizabeth Lewis had decided that Eastmere should be designated the Domesday Village.
This is for the whole country?
For 1986, right, for Hampshire. But it turned out to be for the whole country,
right,
because the Sunday Times then came in, and of course Domesday came from Winchester, and the Sunday Times came in on it, and they did a big supplement about Eastmere and the Domesday Village.
Do we have a copy of it anywhere?
So, yes, it's in the library.
Okay.
Talk about that later. But in fact, I came out of it rather badly because we were fairly new to the village. But people knew that I knew Andrew Neil, who was the editor of the Sunday Times. And when this appeared, the photographer didn't keep very good notes because he took a photograph of the front of our house, which he described as a Georgian townhouse, and he took a photograph of the back of the house, which he described correctly as an Elizabethan house. And everybody thought that I got our photo in twice because I knew the end. And Andrew Adams had nothing to do with the colour setting. But anyhow, there it went. No, the reason that Elizabeth and Edward chose the village was A, that the layout was not very different from when it was a Domesday village. It's not on a main road, so its character hasn't changed. And it does have a larger percentage per head of population of listed villages, listed houses, yeah, than any other village in the county. And so they commissioned a model, which is now in the Musée de la Tapisserie in Bayeux, which is a fantastic model. In fact, I'll tell a little story there. When Trish and I went to visit it, I bought a postcard, and the teenager behind the bar, and I was trying to make, behind the cash desk, I was trying to make conversation, and I said, "Nous habitons," and she looked at me in some pity and said, "C'est joli, monsieur," thinking we lived in a straw house. Anyhow, it's still there, and they also chose it because it's well recorded in the Domesday Book, of course. There are two entries, one for the overall Means Manor, which is the larger parish hundred parish, my brain's gone. But equally, there's the smaller one of Means Ecclesia, which nobody quite knows exactly what it was, and it does vary a bit. It moves around a bit. It was certainly Court Farm, Park Farm, the park, I mean, and now Park Farm, and probably South Farm and Lower Farm. But at times it seems to have included quite a lot of Oxenbourne. Anyhow, that was a much smaller area. But between them, they were the largest and most and richest of the 100/parish of the and manors.
So was the Bishop of Winchester in play in those times?
Absolutely. Well, at the beginning, Archbishop Stigand was a bit of a parvenu because he had, not only Bishop of Winchester, Bishop of Canterbury, had never been done before, never been done after.
Somewhat Canterbury and Winchester.
Yeah, so unsurprisingly, Richard took a negative view of this and demoted him. And when he died, he took over Eastmere as, or he took over Winchester as a royal estate, and Eastmere was thought to be a royal peculiar. I haven't gone into that because I don't really understand it. But then in the 12th century, it battled backwards and forwards. Stephen gave it back to Henri of Blois, who was his brother, and by then Bishop of Winchester, and then Henry III took it back again because he wanted to pay for Dorchester Castle, and then it came back into the diocese. But basically, for 1,000 years, the Bishop of Winchester were the lords of the manor.
So at what stage did we see the development of all these glorious hall houses in Eastmere?
Well, basically the ones we have today are 14th century onwards. The three best are Riverside and Forge Sound, which are next to a crossing over the river, which are probably the oldest and the best preserved as medieval houses. Edward was very excited that the new owner, Edward Roberts, when the new owner took in Riverside. It had been owned by a man called Leal Wyatt, who would never let anybody in, and they were very suspicious. But the new guy not only let them in, let us in, but actually is refurbishing it, and Edward established that it's a much more important house than he'd realised. Forge Sound, where Tony Perkins lives, is a perfectly preserved and delicious little yeoman's cottage. And our house, the hall house, the Tudor house, was then a 2.5-bay hall house along the road, and subsequently developed in the 16th century into a Tudor house.
Right.
And of course, the courthouse itself was immensely important, and is still the best preserved of the bishops' palaces, but in those days was simply the hall itself, with bishops' quarters at one end and a chapel at the other. Mm. And the hall was used for administration, and the servants of the diocese lived there and slept on the floor and looked after the farm. And twice a year they would have courts lead, or manorial courts, which would administer. So that was the administrative hub. And of course, in the meantime, the church is far larger than a parish warrants, but was then a parish that stretched right to the Sussex border and beyond. And it was hugely important. And the bishops were the rectors of Eastmere, All Saints, which means that they got the greater tithes, which meant they pocketed all the money, both the tithes and the rental from the land and the produce from the land. So it's not surprising they gave quite a lot back in terms of developing an absolutely stunning church, which we have to this day, thanks to the Victorian vicar being too mean to do much to it. So we escaped the Victorian depredation. That's my theory, anyhow.
So, I mean, the other thing in the background is the bishop recorded everything, or his people did, in the pipe vault.
Yeah.
So it was unique record of the history.
Yes, so stunning.
The Latin is after it.
If you can follow the Latin.
Yeah. Is that ever going to be fully translated, do you think?
No, certain years have been translated, as you know.
Have been translated.
And I've tried reading some of the Latin, and you can get the hang of it. It's both the handwriting and the text. Some of them have been printed up, so you can sort of understand it a bit easier.
You need to get some intelligent software, maybe.
I'd have to understand all the...
I could do that.
And every scribe had different shorthand, so it's a nightmare. To this, I owe Edward a great deal, because when I had difficulty, I'd go to him.
Mm.
But there were other records. There was a land rental. There were... it's pretty well documented. And, of course, in the 14th century, Archbishop... 14th century, the Archbishop gave some of his men to Magdalen College to help fund it, because he founded it.
Yeah.
Archbishop Wickham.
Yeah.
And that's well recorded. They've got wonderful records there.
Okay, so this was the background to the history. You then mentioned early on that there was a people's village website, and then you had so many inquiries about Eastmere and family trees and everything, you felt the need to start a history group and a website for the history group.
Yes, which is slightly ironical, because I've never done the history. Well, I did ancient history at Oxford, but it's nothing to do with modern history. And I happened to be asked by my golf club, which is Liphook, because I was a journalist, to write their history. Two old dears had, I shouldn't call them that, two very enterprising but elderly gentlemen had done all the research, which was a nightmare. There were piles of stuff. So I discovered what it means to take a lot of sources, sort them out, and write them up. And that gave me not the appetite, but a sort of an awareness of what could happen. Anyhow, as I mentioned, there was always a page of history on the website. We had a very good history, very thorough history, written by a solicitor called Freddie Stanfield in the 1980s and 90s. Very thorough, but slightly dull. But anyhow,
very, very dull.
You said that, like, impossible. That gave us the basis of. I sort of boiled that down, and the then vicar, Terry Loudon, was a keen historian, and he gave a lecture or a sermon, I suppose, gave us a talk anyhow on the history of Eastmead. So I had the raw materials, and then people kept writing in. And both telling me things, but also making inquiries. So what they told me, I put on the website where possible. And when they made inquiries, I tried to find somebody who could deal with them. There were two main sources. One was the vicar. The other was a splendid man called Dennis Ryder, who had made his fortune in chicken batteries.
Battery farming.
Yeah. Along with an Eastmead resident called Brian Blacker. But they did this at Steep Farm. And in 1969, Dennis moved to the mill, Frogmore Mill, and converted it. Well, he moved into the house and subsequently converted the mill. And Dennis was one of these people who knew everybody. It was a wonderful network. He would know every farmer, every cottager, and he would know their parents and so on. So he would put his tendrils out and find out the answers. So when people wrote about asking about their ancestors, they wrote from Australia, Canada, America, you name it, and England. And I passed them on to Dennis, and he would tell me what he could, which was fine if they still had living relatives. And the vicar would look up the church register. But I discovered that some of Dennis's stuff was not entirely accurate. So little by little, I decided we had to do something a bit more methodical. And indeed, at that point, the parish website was becoming a burden. It was partly became me and Matters, partly became a parish website. And I kept hold of the history part, and I did a history website with a bit of money from the parish council, designed by a man called Robert Gerard and WordPress. And Dennis was a great help. Dennis put me on to Robert Gerard, because Dennis, of course, had his websites. He was a great digital experimenter.
Yes.
He would never do anything the orthodox way. Everything would be an experiment, and usually failed anyhow. That's by the by.
Robert still maintains one of our websites today.
So yes,
I still have battles with him.
Well, he's a lovely, you know him.
Yeah.
Anyhow, we then launched the history group, which I only knew one historian in the area, and that was a man called Tim Concannon, who is a QC who works out of Portsmouth, but he lives, I think, in Steep, or one of those villages. And I asked him to come and give a talk about his theory that Eastmead was, before the Normans came, was a very important minster, i.e. a lay community that used the church for its worship, and it's in the hall of the Bishop's Palace. Well, it wasn't the Bishop's Palace, the hall for communal work. And I asked him to come and talk about this, and he got some stuff from the sector. But he gave the most discursive and inaccurate talk you ever heard. He took in the whole of the Saxons, and it was terrible. Anyhow, enough people came to that I knew there was the basis of a history group. And that was in February. In May that year, I invited Edward to come and do a guided tour Tudor house.
Yeah.
And that was lovely. And then we started to meet we also got the, Doug Saunders, from Brereton, who had been running the Brereton Association, which did a lot of history. They've been doing it for 20 years at that time.
Doug Jones.
What did I say? Doug Jones. Yeah, Doug Jones. And he came with Lynette, his number two, who did all the clerical work. We've never had one of those. We need one now. We've always needed one. And they came and gave us the talk on what they had done. And out of that grew a society which would meet in people's sitting rooms. So we were limited to about... We limited the number of members to 25 because most sitting rooms could only take about 18 or 20. And we had a variety of speakers, some of whom were invited. We went to visit the Hampshire Record Office, and it grew and grew. Then we had our first big initiative on the research front, because a speaker came to talk, and I'm just forgetting his name, on tracing history of houses.
Right.
Damn, brain's going. It's on the website.
It's on the website.
Yeah. He's a splendid speaker. He had been the first researcher on Who Do You Think You Are, in the days when
the TV programme on Tracing the Family.
He was then an archivist or a curator at Kew, and the BBC had found him. And instead of pretending that all the research sort of just comes up magically, he was the guide and mentor of the family, of the celebrities whose families were being traced.
Right.
And he did, Nick Barrett, and he did a book, and he did a very good talk and was incredibly helpful in guiding us on how to do house histories, which about a dozen of us then did. And then we had an exhibition that year, 2011, on house histories, which the panel per building. It wasn't just houses, it was the church, it was the whole house. One should mention that there was some very interesting estates in Eastmead: Bearley, Leydean, Westbury, and Borden, which are sort of stately homes, but because Eastmead's never had a squire as such, or never had a lord, a resident lay lord of the manor, were simply successful houses, successful families that had established houses. So we did some of those, we did some of the old houses, we also did Victorian houses, we did the school, and so on, the almshouses. So it was quite an interesting history of the village. We also had a lovely lady called Marjorie Lambert, who was a district nurse, who, with Dennis's help, drew a map which is totally topographically inaccurate, but very accurate in terms
of... It's on our website.
Who remembered who did what in every one of the houses. So as you looked up the high street, you could see there was not only the shops, but there was a wheelwright and a coffin maker and so on. Because the whole village was entirely
so... At what stage did you start to think of going to get grants for research?
Well, that came next. We then began to accumulate rather more material in the form of quasi-archives and photographs and so on than we could cope with. So I applied to the Hampshire Heritage Fund, the Heritage Lottery Fund, for a grant to build, or to have an open day, ostensibly. And the open day was the 1/7th of the iceberg, because we invited villagers to bring their records, which we would then scan. We didn't ask to keep them. We scanned them and indexed them, and want to put them on a website. So the 6/7ths of the iceberg was to get a very ambitious website, database really, built by a firm in Brighton, which Community Sites, which it was the most ambitious site they'd done to then, because they had an archive facility. We got the Hampshire Record Office to look at other, to advise us on other sites, but the other ones were just too too anally academic. And anyhow, so we built the website, and we also that year got involved in the Saxons in the Meon Valley, which was an initiative that came out of Corehampton and Meonstoke, some very enterprising people. We don't have much Saxon relics in East Meon, because the church was built on the old Saxon
church. That's the Norman church,
and the hall was built on the...
It was horrible that we didn't find any records when they built the church hall. It was a big hope we found some of the Saxon thing.
Well, it was too far against the wall. But anyhow, that enabled us to entertain the young at the open day with the reenactment of the Battle of Hastings. So they brought helmets and tabards, and that was great fun. It was a wonderful day. About 300 people came, and that was the basis of our archive, which subsequently we also that was where most of the money went that time, or where all the money went that time, the website, the archive, and the open day, and the scanning. We also started...
I have to say this one, of course, we've now renamed that, the archive created by Michael Blackstone.
Thank you for that. It sets the bar. We also got involved in all the histories at about that time, because one of the talks we used to go, the record office always provided speakers, and one of the speakers talked about all the history, and we visited the record office a couple of times. That they've been a great supporter and mainstay of the group. So we got a coach who was not terribly good, and she ran a seminar on what to do and what not to do. She was bad, but the results were quite good. And I think we've done about 18 or 20 now.
More than that, because I've done 3 or 4 recently.
Yeah, okay. And the rules are very strict, as you know. You've got to do a transcript, you've got to get permissions, you've got to log it. I don't think that we really need to do all that, because do we give the transcripts and the audio to the museums now?
We haven't recently. I must look into that.
Yeah, that was the purpose of all the disciplines.
Having taken over from Michael running the website, I haven't been doing that.
Well, I'll tell you about that.
We'll look at that.
And do you want me to go on about that?
Yeah, let's... obviously, the thing that this has all led to is the major research project we recently completed, which is the Farming in the Valley project, which really, as you say in your introduction, farming is the industry of the village, it's the story of the village.
Well, it's also a sort of a stepping stone in the evolution of the history group. I've always said that if there are now 50 members odd, about a fifth of those will be active, of whom about a half will be active in administrative ways and run the group, and choose the speakers and do the money.
That's certainly true.
And the other half, plus a few others who are not totally committed, would be willing to do serious research, and you're one of those, and a man called David Hopkins was originally extremely useful and assiduous in doing that, and there were 4 or 5 others. So, because research is, as you well know, quite time-consuming and needs a certain set of skills. Anyhow, we got enough people. We had 2 workshops in my house in the Green in 2016, and we decided that this would be run from the bottom up. People wouldn't be told what to do. They choose a subject, and they choose a subject that was either a period or a farm or an estate or a topic. And most people went for topics because that's what I found the most interesting, so it was poverty or pestilence or whatever. But and the things that they didn't do, I ended up doing for the most part, or you did with Betty. And for 2 years we did these researches, most of which have turned into research reports, which are at a sort of half-finished stage. They need finishing, they need finalising. And one of them we have finalised, that's the history of the church. But the other ones, they're on the website as PDFs, and I think they have some use because they've got references.
Yeah, very good.
But anyhow, and I then set out to turn them into a book. Now, books are not cheap. Nobody was going to publish this book commercially. So I got another grant of sheer luck. One of our speakers had been a man called David Sperling, who is I discovered is very involved in something called the Hampshire Archive Trust. I think that's the name. And they turned out to have quite a lot of money they wanted to spend. And I applied for quite a lot of money to do the book. I had also applied to the lottery fund again for a grant to do the cartography, because we decided to do farming, obviously. You can't do farming over the periods without maps, because people had no idea, you know, topology is vastly important. So we had two grants. We had the 7,000 grant to do the maps, and another 7,000 to do the books, and the design and all the rest of it. So we've always had a designer called Zoe Kay, who's a remarkable lady. She's not famous. She's not particularly stylish or whatever. I shouldn't use that word. But she's not trendy. And she works extremely extremely inexpensively and efficiently. For instance, she's very good at proofreading and all the rest of it. She's very organized. And I was very keen that she designed the book. She, in turn, worked with a man called Paul Martin, who's a Brereton man, who ran a design agency. And I think the end design is very good indeed. And we, anyhow, to cut a long story short, we produced the book in November, it was published in November 2019.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the book's been widely praised and we're delighted with it. The problem now is in the group that we don't have anything immediately for our next research project. Now that we have many people wishing to participate, so we need another sort of generation.
You've got to the strong arm then.
Yes, to do things. Yeah. Okay, so I think that brings our chat on the history group to an end, unless you've got anything else to say.
I don't think so. Oh, I just mentioned that because the committee came up with some fairly ingenious financial ideas on the book. We did a hardback which sold for pre-sold for about £100,
and they got sponsors' name in the book,
and they got their names in, and then the book itself sold for £25. The 60 copies, hardback copies, I think we sold about 35 or 40. And they put a lot of money in the back, covered the cost of the printing. So the other sales and have left a bit of money over. And there was more money in the grant for doing archives and whatever.
Well, that's the final thing. You should talk about the image library.
Yeah. Well, the where we started with the original Heritage Lottery Fund, the pictures continued to grow. And I had been... We continued the tradition that we wanted digits, not paper. And there's probably 3,000 more images on my disk. And there's also as many documents, which we must talk about. And I wanted to make those much more accessible. The website was okay, the archive website, thanks to Google, because you could search and find things. But it's still a lot of stuff that wasn't on it. So the rest of the grant that the Hampshire Archive Trust gave us went towards, well, it didn't really go towards, because we haven't spent it. But anyhow, there was money in the bank, so I persuaded the committee that we should do a favour to the church, and we put some of the money towards producing a short history of All Saints Church at our expense, which they could then sell and raise money for the roof and what have you. It's meant as a guidebook, but it's got more than most guidebooks, because it's got quite a I hope colourful history of what the position of the church was, and that grew out of the research done for Farming the Valley. And there's plenty of work, I think, to be done developing some of the things that we didn't finish.
The thing I'd love to see finished, and we never really got cracking with it, was the history of Bailey as a choosing estate. I think that would be fascinating.
Well, Bill was supposed to give a talk, and he probably will.
Yeah, Ian was really well. Yeah. We'll record it, don't worry.
Yeah. But, there's lots of
I asked Bill how he'd like to show his slides, and he said, I won't have any.
Yeah, of course.
That's a good starting point.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Michael. That's been fascinating.
Can we talk about Myanmar matters?
Let's talk about relationship to Myanmar matters as a final topic.
I've always been very fond of Myanmar matters. It was founded by a great friend of mine who died last year, called Chris Bruff, as a church newsletter. And it was originally a cut-and-paste job, mainly done by his secretary and his firm's photocopier. He was an estate agent. He then moved to France, and some of us kept it going. And then it fell into the very capable hands of Dennis Ryder, who made it far more glossy. And it became a really, and then Mark Atkinson made it a really glossy village magazine, which somehow covered its costs.
Eventually couldn't.
Its philosophy has always been that what you write appears, which I think is possibly something they could work on, because the material, some of it's fascinating. But so it's auto-generated. It's not an editorial. The editorial consists of getting the pages together, getting it to the printers and distributing it. Early last year, it found it couldn't cover its costs. So I had been rebuffed twice, once by Dennis and once by Mark, when I suggested that we should merge that with the village website, and that people who could would read it on the web, and then you could have up-to-date information at your fingertips. But those who didn't would have a print copy which they could access. Because there'd always be a lot of people, myself included, who like to have a hard copy lying around.
Dinosaurs, we call them.
Yeah. It's quicker to turn a page than to turn on the computer sometimes. Anyhow. They agreed to do that last year, and that's what it is today. How it's working, I don't know.
I've lost touch. Okay, I mean, obviously, we've got lots of references and many articles from Myanmar matters on the archive website, yeah. So it's an important source of historical data as well.
Yes, I mean, yes, I certainly dug into it, and I got blanket permission to use their photographs and stuff, and that has been useful. But they don't keep it terribly scientifically.
It's interesting, there's now other websites going, or Facebook pages going on East Meon. There's East Meon Memories, which is a Facebook group with about 200 people on, which puts memories and photographs, most of which are in fact on our website already, the history group. But occasionally I pick up a new one. And there's also a fascinating historic photographs of Hampshire Facebook page, which has got all sorts of great stuff on. So it's interesting that Facebook and the web gradually are getting many more people interested in history.
The social media and the way it's going.
Yeah. You were one of the pioneers, so thank you very much.
Well, sort of, but it didn't. I wasn't directly responsible. I did edit one edition of Myanmar Matters, but I never got. I used to write a regular article about history, taken from our research, which is all on the website.
Well, I've just taken over being the editor of the language equivalent, and I was looking back at the archives I inherited, and the very first edition, when it went electronic from cut and paste, says we're struggling to find contributors. But it's not like it used to be. It reminds me
that I managed to compile all the editions of Myanmar Matters and took them to the record office, where future historians, that should continue. And should happen at Squeaker too.
I've got all the electronic copies now.
Yeah.
Anyway, thank you very much, Michael. It's been fascinating.
Okay.
Thank you. That was half an hour.